With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us again today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, monitoring geopolitical issues that are impacting fertilizer prices and availability. We'll have more on that, but our top story today, a group of lawmakers is putting some weight on the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service in response to NAS cutting off some important reports. NAS cited budget restraints when it announced last month that it would stop producing several reports, including the July cattle report, the cotton objective yield survey, and county estimates for crops and livestock reports. U.S. Representative Tracy Mann, a Republican from Kansas, who is also chairman of the House Agriculture Committee's Subcommittee on Livestock, Dairy, and Poultry, is among lawmakers leading the charge to get a turnaround from NAS. I talked with Representative Mann to get more information.
This is something that my listeners have been talking about a lot, and that is, of course, the reports that NAS has said that they're discontinuing. So you jumped right on this and are trying to get that changed. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, and you know, for your listeners that don't know, last month the USDA, National Ag Statistics Service, NAS, announced that they're going to cancel the July cattle report, and they're going to discontinue the cotton objective yield survey and other county estimates for crop and livestock. You know, they did not let us know in advance. They just made this announcement as a someone that grew up on a farm. You know, I know firsthand, we rely on this data, this information. Producers need it. There has been no good reason the USDA has given for not putting this report together. So we're leaning hard on them to do what they ought to do, and that's issue these reports here in July.
As you said, too, there was not any advanced warning. There was no, you know, public comment period or anything like that on if they should keep it. Do you think that there's still an opportunity for people to have their voices heard on how important these reports are to them?
I'm optimistic, yeah, and that's why we've been leaning in. You know, a lot of conversations, sent letters, made it very clear, and we have a whole bunch of co-sponsors as well, that this action is not okay. You know, the ag community uses these reports to manage risk, build supply and demand estimates, develop market forecasts, and evaluate the economic impact of natural disasters. You know, canceling or discontinuing these reports hinders our great ag producers' ability to do what they do best, and that's, you know, feed and fuel and clothe the world. So it's very disappointing what we've seen come out of the USDA on this.
So you've sent a letter, and as you said, you've had a lot of, you know, a lot of people have also joined you in voicing their support of keeping these reports going. Can you tell me a little bit about what the letter said?
Well, just the letter said that we're disappointed, you know, Secretary, disappointed in this action, and that the reports need to be issued in July on time. And again, reminding them, and I've been reminding people in this town in Washington, D.C., you know, our producers manage a lot of risk, and you've got to have market information to be able to do that. And that's why just what seems like, you know, willy-nilly pulling this report makes absolutely no sense to me.
Farmers and ranchers, they have to juggle so many different things. And with the cost of everything going up, but especially we've had such high cost of inputs lately, we've had, you know, you never know what the markets are going to do. So many things that they're balancing. To not have this information, and you may know something about this personally, but to not have this information available, what could that mean for a farmer?
Well, it means that they are having to make very large business decisions, marketing decisions without the information. You know, the markets rely on this data. As you know, so that markets work and function. In many ways, you know, good data is one of the bedrocks or the keystones to functioning appropriate markets. And to just withdraw and prevent this information from being assembled, when we know the USDA has the staff, they have the people, they've been doing it for decades. Very, very disappointed, actually infuriating, that this is the action that they've taken, which is why we are pushing back and doing everything that we can do to get them, to convince them to reverse course.
So tell me again a little bit more about what are some of the things that you are able to do to push back?
Well, we've talked to them, you know, talked to their office at a staff level, many phone calls from me to them. We have been in the media about this issue. We sent a letter and got other members of Congress to co-sponsor it. You know, it's a full court press, hands on deck to get them to reverse course.
What would be the importance of producers and farmers, you know, the boots on the ground, joining the lawmakers in voicing their concerns?
I think incredibly important. I think any producer that's frustrated by this action as well, it'd be great if the U.S. Department of Agriculture heard from all producers directly, not just from members of Congress. We're going to keep, jumping up and down and making as much noise about this as we can. But the more producers that they're listening to or hearing from, the better. So I would encourage listeners, you know, if this is something they're concerned about or impacted by, to make that voice known.
And this is probably an unfair question and you don't have to answer it, but I keep racking my brain trying to think of what other business would be forced to try to continue doing business with, you know, one of their main reports, main source of information being just completely taken away from them without any advance notice. I can't think of any other industry.
I can't think of a single one either. Yeah, it just makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah.
You know, why they would do this. It seems arbitrary, seems punitive, and is frankly pretty ridiculous.
So I've got listeners around the nation, and if we were to wrap this, or, you know, sum this all up, what would be what you really want them to know and to remember?
Well, I would just, you know, remember that we've got to make our voices heard. And when things like this occur, you know, we've got to speak up loudly. You know, we're doing that as loudly as I possibly can here in Washington, D.C., but need folks, producers all over the country to do the same thing and to let USDA know that this is not acceptable and that they need to publish the information.
All right. I want to thank you once again for your time. I know that you're busy.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the Agriculture Secretary says the new IRS tax credit policy for sustainable aviation fuel is a big win for climate-smart farmers. Gary Crawford has more.
If you want to start up a brand new industry, one of the best ways to do that is to offer substantial tax credits to those involved. And the IRS has just come out with guidance on how this tax credit approach will work in the case of producing sustainable aviation fuel. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters,
if producers of sustainable aviation fuel are using ethanol that has been produced from corn that has been grown or raised with no-till cover crops and energy-efficient fertilizer, essentially they qualify for the credit, and the IRS basically will either not audit that particular request, or if they do, no penalties will be assessed.
Now, this also generally applies to soybeans.
So, in other words, agriculture's foot is in the door. We're in the game, which we weren't in the game before. Now we are.
And Vilsack told visiting farm broadcasters that this is just the beginning. The door will be opening wider for sustainable aviation fuel produced in 2025 and beyond. Right now, a special government interagency group of experts is beginning its work.
We're going to ask the question, what other commodities beside corn and soybeans ought to qualify? And what other practices beyond no-till, cover crop, and energy-efficient fertilizer should qualify.
And there are dozens of crops and climate-smart farming practices that could potentially be brought in.
And what we'll do over the course of the next 6 to 7 months is work as a group so that we'll be in a position when 2025 comes to essentially create the more lasting program and making sure that agriculture, climate smart agriculture, is fully embraced and involved in the development of sustainable aviation fuel.
Vilsack says this new sustainable aviation fuel industry
will, I think, create opportunities for farmers and producers, will no doubt also support quality job growth in rural communities across the United States.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Might there be a shift in both location and degree of the active weather patterns that have created significant tornado activity over the past 2 weeks? Rod Bain reports.
Active weather in parts of the country this past week.
From April 30th through May 3rd, we saw at least 10 tornadoes each day in that four-day period. A little bit of a break on May 4th and 5th with a single tornado reported those 2 days. And then May 6th, we saw another estimated 17 tornadoes based on very early reports.
With USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey noting since April 25th, and as of Monday, there have been 12 consecutive days with at least one tornado reported in the nation, and over 200 total in that time frame. The active weather trend is expected to continue this week, but with a shift in location. The Mid-South and Lower Midwest Wednesday, and on Thursday and beyond, the East Coast and Deep South. He adds a late week to weekend weather pattern shift could bring a temporary halt to this stretch of active climatic conditions. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's the Livestock Report. A recent round of testing confirmed our hamburgers continue to be safe from the recent outbreak of bird flu. David Geiger has this report.
Ground beef appears to be safe from bird flu. The U.S. Department of Agriculture tested 30 samples from 9 states with outbreaks of H5N1 in dairy cattle. Grant Duell, an Iowa State University Extension and Outreach beef veterinarian, says the screenings came back negative, which is good news.
It implies that the beef is safe as far as we know. We're not able to find any fragments. Plus, since we do cook our beef, then that would degrade that as well. And so beef should be completely safe. I would worry more about other potential food safety pathogens.
The USDA also concludes the beef to be safe. Duell says they are staying careful, though. There are questions on how transmissible this is to beef cattle. As of now, they aren't sure how they might be affected, if it's possible. The virus tends to target mammary glands, so with dairy cattle, he says it's easier to decide the best areas to test.
With beef cattle, we don't have daily milk samples, and so we don't really have a whole lot of indication about which ones to target testing, and so the testing that has been done has all been negative. Again, whether that's just not we're not identifying the right clinical cases as of yet, or whether beef are somewhat more resistant to it, remains to be seen.
And while Duell notes biosecurity is the best way to manage H5N1 risk, he acknowledges the challenge of managing migrating birds. He has 2 recommendations.
When we're buying new beef cows, isolating those from our main herd until we make sure that everything's healthy, potential for testing some of those, and then general sanitation in on your farm as far as making sure our feed's covered as best as possible so we don't have a bird contaminate those.
I'm David Geiger reporting.
We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. With a preview of what you'll be hearing today on AgNet West, here's Farm News Director Brian German.
Weed scientists are commending recent updates to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's herbicide strategy. The Weed Science Society of America is praising EPA's efforts to simplify compliance for farmers while protecting endangered species. Chair of the organization's Endangered Species Act Committee, Bill Chisholm, said the updates reflect EPA's willingness to listen to stakeholder concerns. He also noted that the organization's working with the EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, and the USDA to provide scientifically based data to help decision makers develop mitigations with the least impact on production agriculture. The proposed updates aim to curb spray drift, runoff, and erosion to minimize adverse effects on endangered species and their habitats. WSSA applauds the EPA's intention to finalize its strategy by August 30th, incorporating these measures into herbicide labels. Several geopolitical issues continue to impact fertilizer price and availability. President and CEO of the Fertilizer Institute, Corey Rosenbusch, highlighted some of the issues they're monitoring.
We've got shipping channels that are being disrupted in the Red Sea. There was a situation where a vessel full of fertilizer completely sunk after being fired upon by the Houthi rebels in the Red Sea. Most of that Middle Eastern production supply is having to come down via South Africa, the Cape of Good Hope, and then back up into Europe. And you can just imagine what that does to both supply chain timing as well as costs associated with delivering fertilizer. So we watch that. We watch what's going on in Israel. Obviously, Israel is still a large producer of fertilizer. And so all of those geopolitical issues continue to be on the forefront and things that we just have to watch as the year continues.
The National Cattlemen's Beef Association and Public Lands Council criticized the final Phase 2 rule amending the National Environmental Policy Act. The Biden administration says the rule aims to simplify and modernize the federal environmental review process with key changes that include streamlining permitting for renewable energy and transmission projects, introducing deadlines and page limits for reviews, and considering climate and environmental justice impacts. However, industry groups argue that instead of reducing regulatory burdens as intended, the rule makes the NEPA process more burdensome for livestock producers. NCBA and PLC believe the rule makes NEPA more ambiguous, difficult, and costly, particularly for federal permitting, including grazing permits. They also express concerns that it could empower radical activist groups to exploit NEPA against ranchers and rural communities. The UC Davis College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences will be hosting the 65th Annual Weed Day next month. The event offers an opportunity to learn about the latest University of California weed science research. Pest control advisors, growers, farm advisors, industry cooperators, and regulatory officials are all encouraged to attend on Wednesday, June 26th at the Bueller Alumni Center on the UC Davis campus. The event begins with a morning field tour of the UC Davis weed science research plots. The afternoon session will take place in the Bueller Alumni Center, where UC faculty, staff, and students will present information on projects that are not in season for viewing or research located off campus. Presentations will include basic research showing the scope of the weed science program. More information about the 65th Annual Weed Day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
A look at the cost of the Texas Panhandle wildfires, that's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service economists project the Panhandle wildfires caused $123 million in preliminary agricultural losses, making it the costliest on record. The wildfires began on February 26 and burned 1.2 million acres, making it the largest wildfire in Texas history. The losses include more than 12,000 dead cattle, lost grazing values, and fence repair costs, according to the economists. Other estimates include $68.7 million in lost ranch infrastructure, fences, barns, corrals, well pump motors, windmills, and stocks of hay or feed. They estimate $26 million lost in long-term grazing and fire-damaged pastures and short-term emergency feeding costs. Producers lost an estimated $27 million worth of cattle, which includes both cattle and estimated losses of the season's calf crop. The NRCS provides conservation programs for organic producers. Randall Wiseman tells us more.
Now, this includes the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, Conservation Stewardship Program, and the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. And if you're an organic producer, yes, this includes you. Last year, NRCS started providing assistance for a new organic management conservation practice as part of USDA's Organic Transition Initiative. The new organic management practice allows flexibility for producers to get the assistance and education they need. That includes attending workshops or requesting help from experts and mentors. It also supports organic conservation activities and practices required for organic certification and may provide foregone income reimbursement for dips in production during the transition period.
That was Randall Wiseman reporting. Several aspects about decision makers on the farm and ranch level are discovered when combing through the data of the 2022 Census of Agriculture. Rod Bain looks at some of those findings in the second part of a two-part series in this edition of Agriculture USA.
The Census of Agriculture, the premier data set regarding farming, ranching, food, feed, and fiber production in our nation. The latest edition of the Census, covering the year 2022, provides the Agriculture Department and Census users and stakeholders opportunity to learn more about the people within the ag sector.
I'm happy to share a little bit about the demographics of farm producers. This is one of the unique items from the Census of Agriculture, and one thing that is only available from the Census of Agriculture through NAFS.
I'm Rod Bain. Virginia Harris of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service joins us as we look at the demographics of the 2022 Census of Agriculture, the second of a two-part series in this edition of Agriculture USA. Demographics have always been a key data set within USDA's Census of Agriculture series. What do the numbers reveal regarding the most recent census conducted in the year 2022? National Agricultural Statistics Service statistician Virginia Harris delved into some of the demographics during this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum. Much attention is given each census cycle to the average age of ag producers, as that has trended up. Yet, what about demographics on young farmers?
A young producer is defined as anyone who was under the age of 35 as of December 31st, 2022. Young producers may be running their own farm, or they may be involved in a farming operation with other producers, whether they're family members or others.
And new and beginning farmers.
A new and beginning producer is defined as anyone who has operated any farm for 10 years or less, which would include the census year. Not all new and beginning producers are young. In fact, the average age of a new and beginning producer is 47.1 years old, which is lower than the average age of all producers.
Key takeaways from the 2022 Census of Ag regarding young farmers include:
the number of younger producers increased almost 4% from the previous census cycle, and the largest increases are seen in the Midwest and in the Great Lakes states. Some specializations are much more likely to have a young producer. For example, grain and oilseed farms are more likely to include young producers than, say, other crop farms. Young producers are much more likely than other age groups to make decisions regarding livestock. On average, young producers, though, participated in fewer decisions than older producers.
As for data trends for new and beginning farmers within the latest census,
overall, 30% of all producers are new and beginning, and 33% of all farms have beginning producer involved in decision making for the farm operation. The number of new and beginning producers was up 11.4% compared to the previous census. Farms with new and beginning producers tend to be smaller than average, both in terms of sales and acres operated.
Another demographic category studied under the 2022 Census of Agriculture: military veterans as farm operators.
Overall, 9% of producers have served in the U.S. military, either currently or in the past. The average age of a producer with military service is 68 years old, so they are much older on average than farmers overall. The number of producers with military service decreased 18% from the previous census. The share of farms with producers who served in the military also varies across the country, with the highest share of farmers with military service in the Southeast.
The census survey contained two separate question tracks regarding ethnicity and race.
So we asked all farmers to report both their ethnicity, either they have Hispanic origin, and then to separately report their race.
Among the findings on farm operators based on ethnicity and race within the 2022 census:
farms with Hispanic, American Indian, and Black producers decreased. You can also see this trend in the number of producers for these race categories. There was a small increase in the number of farms with producers of Asian and Native Hawaiian origin. Farms with American Indian producers and Black producers tend to be smaller in terms of average sales. Farms operated by producers of different races and ethnicities vary by size and sales, both based on their location and the type of agricultural production they specialize in.
More details about the demographics associated with the latest Census of Agriculture are available currently online at www.nass.usda.gov/agcensus, all one word, or through upcoming reports released during the year. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You've put a lot of work into that vegetable garden of yours, but how can you keep the critters from stealing you blind? Gary Crawford has this report.
And now, a word from a farmer.
This is Farmer Fudd. I was just starting my chores when I happened to look over toward my carrot patch, and who do you think I saw right in the middle of it eating my carrots? It was that waskowy widow Gray Rabbit, Bugs Bunny.
But actually, from the standpoint of home gardeners,
I can't recall many people complaining about rabbits eating carrots. I hear a lot of complaints about them eating green beans.
Green beans. Well, he should know. Charlie Lee, an Extension wildlife expert, Kansas State University. If you have a home garden, you know sometimes the critters get more of your crop than you do. The question is, what can you do about it? The answer?
Have a proper fence.
A fence. And Charlie Lee says an electric fence is probably best.
There are many types of garden fences available now that are actually a plastic type strand or twine with little strands of stainless steel wire woven through them so that they will conduct electricity. You then hook that up to a fence energizer, and it has small mesh at the bottom, small enough that will keep out critters even the size of a turtle. And it gets larger mesh up at the top.
Now, it's not a fence that will keep the dinosaurs inside Jurassic Park, but rather one powered either by batteries or a low-voltage AC line. And Charlie Lee says,
electric fencing is designed to be a psychological barrier, not a physical barrier. And it may seem that, yes, deer could easily jump over the fence, but if it's out and very visible and you train the deer to touch the fence by putting a scent on it, usually use peanut oil or peanut butter, and make it very visible, it's going to be very effective at excluding deer.
Now, if you have to go with a non-electric fence, it will have to be at least 2 feet tall, preferably more. Of course, there are other things out there for sale that claim to repel critters from your garden.
Those are not effective 100% of the time. In fact, most of them are not effective 50% of the time.
Now, some folks claim if you put certain flowers and plants around the garden, that will repel some animals. But Charlie Lee says research shows if you depend on that,
you're probably not going to be very successful.
But there is one age-old technique that, properly used, can be effective.
And that would be as simple as the old scarecrow.
I would dance and be merry. Life would be a ding-a-derry if I only had a brain.
Not that scarecrow, but Charlie Lee says a dancing scarecrow would be very effective. But one that just stands there day after day, doesn't have any movement, doesn't get moved around the garden frequently, will not work.
Wildlife are pretty smart. They realize that there's no hazard associated with that scarecrow, and then learn to come in and share what you have to offer.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has this week's Almond Update.
In this week's Almond Update from the Almond Board of California, ABC's Taylor Hillman discusses the Seeds for Bees program from Project Apis M with program manager Stetson Maldonado.
Again, this year, the Seeds for Beads program, for those who don't know what this is or who have heard about this in the past and may be interested, what is the Seeds for Beads program?
So the Seeds for Bees program is a free seed program through Project Apis M. And what we do is in the first year, for first year participants, they get up to $2,500 worth in free seed. And then second year participants get up to $1,500 in free seed. And then any returning applicants can continue to reapply and they're able to purchase discounted seed through our program.
That's great. So not only for someone trying this new, but for someone who has done this before, there is incentives here to come back and get some sort of a help financially wise.
Yeah, and then since we purchase so much seed, we get the wholesale price, which we pass on to our growers.
Awesome. Let's talk about some of the seeds. We've done this before, the mixes. You guys have mixes. There's different types of mixes you guys have. There are some real popular ones. There are some ones that are specific needs like nitrogen and stuff, right? There's lots of different mixes.
So our most popular one is the Pollinator Brassica, and that one's a mix of all brassicas. People love that one, especially for almonds, because it blooms so early in the year. So you're able to provide that forage before your almonds do and really get your bees going before you need them for your crop. It's also really great at suppressing weeds, and when you terminate it, it's actually toxic to nematodes. Mm. And then we have other mixes. Our second most popular is the Nitro Builder. That one has triticale, common vetch, and daikon radish, and people love that one for the nitrogen fixing that it has. So in good years, you can get up to 100 pounds of nitrogen to the acre.
You mentioned in some of your talks about some of the benefits of cover crops. Let's talk about some of those benefits, maybe the ones that people don't totally know. But the first one that a lot of people know about cover crops is the water filtration. You used a good analogy in there. What was that analogy?
Yeah, so the first benefit that you're going to see with a cover crop in your very first year of planting is improved water infiltration. So your soil is a lot like a sponge. So if you have a sponge that's really open, you got all your pores in there, you can hold a lot more water in there and a lot more air than a sponge that's squished. And so a cover crop really helps with that in getting your rainfall into your soil as quick as possible.
Some growers have mentioned that that it's competition. That cover crops are a competition, and they don't want to be adding that. But it's also competition to weeds, right?
It is, yeah. So cover crops, so Olive Seeds for Bees cover crop mixes are winter cover crops. So they're not going to be competing with your perennial crops, but they are going to be competing with your weeds. So plants naturally take up space and they use resources. So you're going to end up with a plant in your drive row. So it's either one that you picked to be there or it's going to be one that nature threw at you.
So when does this application period open and when does it close?
So we're open from April 1st and we close August 31st.
So we are open now and we've seen a lot of applications come in already, right?
Yeah, we've had a ton of applications already. So the program is always increasing in popularity. So if you're wanting to get your cover crop seed, I would say apply as soon as possible just because seed is limited and you want to make sure that your spot is secured.
And then last thing is the goal of this is to get seed to the grower's door by a certain date, correct?
Yeah, so we do every effort that we can to get seed well before October 1st. And that's just because that sweet spot is planting between early October to mid-October. So we do our best to get it delivered as soon as possible.
If people want to find more out about the Seeds for Bees program or Project APSM, where can they go to do that?
So they can go to our website, and that's projectapism.org. And you'll find a number of tabs there. One of the tabs is the Seeds for Bees tab, and you'll be able to access everything about our program on that webpage.
Now you guys are also working on some videos, I hear, about some grower testimonies, about their experience with the program and cover crops, right?
Yeah, we are working on videos. There's still probably going to be a later release date just because we're talking to growers and starting to film those. But keep an eye out on our YouTube channels and on our webpage, and you'll be able to hear what growers are dealing with on the ground from their perspective.
You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. What is the update regarding cargo shipments and channel restoration over a month after a bridge collapse impeded cargo traffic to and from the Port of Baltimore? Red Bain reports.
Late March, the dramatic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge at the entrance to the Port of Baltimore.
The Army Corps of Engineers is on the spot and is going to help lead this effort to clear the channel.
This is an important port for both imports and exports, which is important for farm equipment.
President Joe Biden and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, respectively, at the initial White House press conference shortly after the incident. Various contingency plans were enacted to divert ship cargo traffic to other ports. Cargo with goods such as farm equipment and commodities like sugar and soybeans. All while partners worked to clear the channel to resume transport of product. Regarding those efforts and what has transpired to date, a place to start is channel restoration. U.S. Trade Representative's Office Chief Agricultural Negotiator Doug McCaleb provided this late April update to farm broadcasters.
11-foot channel come online about 2 weeks after the accident, a 14-foot channel just south of the wreckage come online.
Plus, a temporary 35-foot deep channel allowing for larger cargo ship traffic briefly before debris removal efforts focused on that specific path.
The goal is by the end of May to have two-way traffic 50 foot deep able to accommodate two-way vessel traffic.
Regarding impacts to various aspects of the ag sector, Darren Kopic of the Agricultural Retailers Association says for farm equipment such as combines and implements usually delivered at the Port of Baltimore.
We're told that most of that freight has been diverted or is otherwise not delayed to the extent that people thought it might be.
Then there are various commodities. In fact, within the port is a major sugar processor and distributor. As Luther Marquardt of the American Sugar Alliance explains regarding the commodity his organization represents.
There were two ships that were in and just had unloaded. So they had an inventory of 6 to 8 weeks. And then they were able to float some barges in that don't need the deep water channels. And they were able to get those in. And they just brought in a ship that was brought in the existing channel. We don't need the 50-foot deep one. So there was never a problem or disruption in taking care of customers.
Abroad Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The National Dairy Farmers Assuring Responsible Management, or FARM, program is the U.S. Dairy's on-farm national responsibility program. Here's Chad Smith with more.
One of the important parts of the program is on-farm biosecurity. Emily Iser-Stepp, executive director of the National Dairy Farm Program, says biosecurity is more important than ever after the recent outbreak of highly pathogenic avian influenza in dairy cattle herds.
The farm biosecurity pillar is one that focuses on providing our dairy farmers with the tools to keep their herds and their dairy businesses safe from an unseen threat of disease. As we are working through the high path AI in cattle incident, unfortunately, we've had to really elevate the awareness around this pillar of the farm program to communicate that we do have resources and tools available for operations that have always had excellent biosecurity practices in place. When a threat of a disease is literally knocking on their doorstep, the things that we can do to assist them to minimize the potential continuation of threat of transfer of that disease is really heightened.
She talks about the most important precautions farmers can take.
At a very base level, it's continuing with the implementation of those robust biosecurity protocols that we've reinforced for decades at the farm level. Being able to limit traffic in and out of farms to limiting that to essential individuals by employees and personnel. Certainly, if there is a need to move cattle, being diligent in any pre-testing that can be done, having your veterinarian be engaged at the farm level to identifying if cows are starting to show symptoms. We never want to transport sick animals. It's also reinforcing the importance of doing things that we already know to do and keeping our clothes clean, making sure that we're washing our boots, using disinfectants, and washing our hands.
Iser-Stepp talks about what farmers should do if they notice their animals developing HPAI symptoms.
The first thing that they should do is contact their veterinarian that will then in turn work with the state animal health officials and in turn are their federal partners to communicate and get the appropriate testing mechanisms in place. As part of the farm program, we've emphasized having an active and live veterinarian client patient relationship between the farm and their veterinarian. And that's been a foundational piece that veterinarian is that source of contact that can coordinate with those up the chain, see something, say something to your veterinarian, get the appropriate testing mechanisms in place.
The HPAI outbreak is a quickly changing situation, and she talks about where producers can get more information.
National Milk Producers Federation's website has a banner on their homepage of nmpf.org to take you directly to a HPAI resource page that outlines what we currently know from USDA APHIS about the states with confirmed cases of HPAI, those states that currently have restrictions on dairy cattle movement, outline what are the key signs that they should be looking for in their dairy cattle, resources from farm biosecurity around movements, self-assessment checklists, different templates, posters, different preparation guides that they can reference and utilize as they may be interested or need to as this evolves.
Again, that website for more information is nmpf.org. Chad Smith reporting.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.